I have had, on many occasions, I have had supports of him for my research. In fact, in many conversations that I had, he felt that some of my material, some of my research paper, particularly I sent a copy of it to him, and he felt that it was very compelling, and he felt that the real story behind the October Surprise is the story that I have analyzed.
Right.
However, when he reviewed my work...
Well, before, let me interrupt, Farah, because you asked me, because he has recently come into print...
Yes.
Vis-a-vis your work. But before that happened, you asked me what I thought of him and what I thought he would say about
yes,
your work.
I would, yes, you're right. What it was about 10 days before the review came out, and
right.
I asked you that what your opinion was of David McMichael, and you, with reservation, you said that I should be very careful because the situation has been in the past that he really did not, as he tells you that he is going to do something, the result and the outcome of the conversation has been always very surprisingly different than the things that people have heard from him before the publication of the review on the work. And to be very honest with you, when he told me that, I took that kind of very uncomfortably, because I felt, well, why would be, and what is the reason that you would have such a reservation about his reviewing of my work?
And again, for the benefit of listeners, I caution that, in my opinion, David McMichael was not necessarily the vehement critic of the CIA that he professes to be. The notion of ex-CIA is a very dubious one, as dubious, in my opinion, with David McMichael as in a different way with Frank Turple or Edwin Wilson. But I expressed reservations, to say the least, about him, and I voiced my opinion that when he went into print, he would dump on what you had to say.
And surprisingly enough, when I talked to him, he was supposed to send me a copy of his magazine, monthly magazine called Unclassified. And he gave me a review, which unfortunately I don't have the documents in front of me because it's all, you know, at the house that I cannot even get within the 100 feet of my own house and my own material. This is really bizarre. He reviewed in general term. First of all, he twisted the whole thing around. That this, in his opinion, I presented that this was a botched CIA operation. I never said that in my entire work.
On the contrary, you have said that it was a highly successful and extremely sophisticated operation.
That's correct.
Right.
An entire review that he has given did not present one word about my assessment of the George Bush's role in the whole operation. Not one.
And beyond that, I will reiterate for the benefit of the audience, one of the things McMichael did say was that Farah Mansour presents the October Surprise as the either the outgrowth of a bungled CIA operation, which is completely misrepresenting your research.
That's correct.
Yep. And beyond that, he had some other things to
and
say.
And then he also referred that the Khomeini's regime was, in fact, fighting against the military coup that at one time was behind him by the CIA support, and later on he went against his sponsors to get a control of Iran. And this is not in my entire research. You wouldn't find that word.
Right.
And thirdly, he referred to the Tudor Party, which was the Communist Party of Iran, as the strongest leftist party in Iran. In my entire research, there is not such a word. In fact, I have referred to Fedayeen guerrillas and Mujahideen rather than the Tudor Party, because the Tudor Party, although that they were very effective in the 50s, in during 1977 and 78, really they were not that effective within the Iranian Revolution, although they participated. So the total presentation of my work as a review work was a blatant misrepresentation of what I have worked on.
Something else that struck me, too, is he indicated that Gary Sick didn't think much of your work,
yes,
either.
In fact, in parentheses at the end, he has referred that this assessment of my work was not, I mean, when it was presented to Gary Sick, he thought it to be very unlikely. For fact, I know that Mr. Gary Sick, in his entire research work, whether he's October Surprise or his book called All Fall Down, and many of his articles that he has written in different books. I have read practically everything that Gary Sick has written about what has happened in Iran. I did not find his information to be anything close to what was going on in Iran. It was marginally true, but never touched on many important issues. Now, the question is this. I've been asked by quite a few of my friends and colleagues, did he deliberately do that?
Gary Sick, you mean?
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
I don't know. Did he know about it? He should have known about it. That was his job, because he was an assistant to Brzezinski at the White House, and he should have known that.
By the way, among the outgrowths in the wake of our first two interviews, Farah, was a rumor that was being circulated that you and Gary Sick were very good friends, and that your name was really Mansour Farhang and not Farah Mansour.
That is not true. In fact, I have not had any conversation with Mr. Gary Sick, with the exception of one conversation that I had with him some times ago, which Gary Sick, on his tour in Southern California, he was heard on Carol Hemingway.
You mentioned that, right?
Yes, and I got on there and asked him certain question, and he did not answer my questions properly, and I have got all the documents that I have discussed that with you. And the second time that I have talked to him was on January 12, 1993. I don't have any relationship with Mr. Gary Sick. And I tell you, I did ask him at the end of my conversation with him that at sometimes in the future, I would be very much looking forward to be on some sort of a panel to discuss the issue of the October Surprise with him, because many questions that I have. You see, it troubles me when Gary Sick, a man of his stature, praises a man like Eric Von Marbot and make him look like a man that the United States government and the people of the United States are so much indebted to him. Okay? That troubles me.
Yep.
It troubles me when Gary Sick goes to so much detail of what was happening in Iran, but he forgets an entire book that he has written about Iran. Not one mention of a man like General Ghalani, who was actually the custodian of all U.S. military investment in Iran. I mean, to me, these things, it is very puzzling. It's not what Gary Sick has talked about. This is not where my investigation started. My investigation started when I found out there were many things that Mr. Gary Sick and people that I would consider them one-eye experts or one-dimensional experts have not written anything about.
Right.
One thing about your work that I like, and people like you that they do research and investigation, when people write about Iranian history, they have to also keep in mind the influence of the U.S. political involvement and its influence in Iran, and also some of the internal struggle that exists within this country. Now, when people write about Iranian history and Iranian revolution, they also have to have a knowledge of what the CIA and the national security establishment within this country, what role they played within this country, and what role they played globally to affect the outcome of certain events in these countries. It's not the first time that these things have happened. It has happened all over the world. So if you are going to look at the Iranian revolution, there was nothing that the CIA created in Iran. But however, through the knowledge of what they knew was going on in Iran,
right,
they were able to manipulate it.
Right. Now, well, we've been through this before. I just simply wanted to put a wrap on things and point out that already you're getting the kind of treatment that I've been subject to and other researchers of character have been subject to, rather than people, and certainly many people have responded positively and enthusiastically, but that sort of preposterous rumor that you were, among the many rumors that immediately began circulating, was that, one, you weren't really who you are, but you were a professor at Middlebury College in Vermont and a good friend of Gary Sick's. Nothing could be further from the truth. And then you mentioned to me, as I said before, the publication by McMichael, that McMichael had spoken very highly of your work, and then he went into print and not only distorted what you had to say, but basically dumped on it, albeit not very enthusiastically.
This is one thing that I really have to be very fair. One of the two things that happened, mm-hmm. whether he told me that he read my material mm-hmm. and he didn't understand what he read,
mm-hmm.
all right, or he deliberately put it in a format that it does not reflect my research. And mm-hmm. besides, one thing that I want to tell you, he spelled my name, F-A-R-A-H, which mm-hmm. is a female's name in Farsi language.
Mm-hmm.
Now, anybody who had the position of my paper right on the top would have seen that my name was spelled F-A-R-A.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it, whether it was sloppiness in his part, whether it deliberately is done, the outcome of it is the same.
Mm-hmm. Point is, I warned you about him, and I one thing that I've taken a lot of flack for over the years is my extreme distaste, with a capital E and a capital B, for these quote X unquote CIA guys who make the rounds. And we're talking about Ralph McGahee, who's about as shallow as can be, John Stockwell and others, some of whom have had some good information to offer, but none of them goes anywhere near as far as information that's already on the public record. There have been some people, ex-intelligencers, not necessarily CIA, like Gene Wheaton, who have come forward with some good information, but I am, to say the least, leery of all of these people. And I just, when you told me that David McMichael had access to your work and had spoken highly of it, I warned you that I didn't think he would ever come out in print and say that, based on his past performance.
This is very unfortunate, David, because mm-hmm. you touching on the area that people that they really spend a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
I really have paid a very high price for this research.
Right.
And when you see all of a sudden somebody like David McMichael goes and within few lines try to distort what I have represented,
mm-hmm.
then you ask yourself, why you have to trust anybody?
Well, you do have to trust some people, but I would caution against trusting a quote X unquote CIA agent, you know?
Right. And I feel that I am very grateful and I'm very appreciative for all the time and opportunity that I had to present my paper on your program. The surprise that I promised you that I gave you tonight. And
mm-hmm.
I think that for this information that you heard and your audience heard, it was aired for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is that these are the information that I am paying a very high price for it today.
I think, Farah, and by way of pointing toward a firm conclusion here, the price you have paid, and that's why I wanted you on to relate what had happened to you since our last interviews, a lot of other people are going to be paying dearly, and I think your perceptions are correct, is that whether it's the Iranian nuclear capability or Islamic fundamentalist terrorism in the United States or elsewhere, ultimately that is going to serve as the pretext for further U.S. military operations, if not during the Clinton administration, then afterward. It may very well also be used as a pretext for destabilization and increased police state tactics at home as well. So I think that price, whether or not people ever give your monumental work the credit it deserves and the recognition that it demands, a lot of other people are going to be paying that price too. As I say on my program, and you've had an opportunity to listen to me for some time, late night down in Los Angeles, what goes around comes around. And sooner or later, what has been going around for you is going to be coming around for an awful lot of other people.
Dave, I want to tell you this. You have been inspirational in the course of very difficult times that I went through within the last 3 years. I mean, to sit down day and night, spending 16, 18 hours a day at the expense of your professional career, put everything beside and sitting down and writing and putting all this research that you have done for 30 years is not an easy job, and you need at one point of time some sort of encouragement. People like you, and especially you, have given me that encouragement. I'm very much indebted to you and your work, and I appreciate the kind of diligent work that you do and the energy that you put behind your work that is very fascinating and very moving for me. I mean, I hope that people, just because of the things that is happening to me, do not stop.
Mm-hmm.
They go on.
Right.
Because the struggle goes on. We can sit down and do all the crying that we want, but what we really are fighting is for those that are alive.
Right.
Now, that is the issue.
Absolutely.
Now, there was an article published in July 23rd, 1992, on Thursday on the LA Time by Robin Wrong, I mean Echo Robin, I'm sorry, Robin Wright, Echo Robin Wrong. She has written an article in regard to titled Panel Demands New Vision for a New World Order. The treatment now, this is a quote, it says, the treatment of foreign policy issue is, quote, somewhere between distressing and appalling. Commission Chairman Winston Lord, former U.S. Ambassador to China and former head of the State Department's policy planning staff, added at the press conference Wednesday, we see no coherent vision here or abroad. Lord said that the United States has only its third chance this century to reshape the world affairs. This is our chance, the report says, to ensure that recent enemies become future enemies, that the present allies do not become new antagonists. Now, what is important is that there is a commission here which I believe that is a Carnegie Endowment Commission, a Carnegie Endowment National Commission on Americas and the New World Ways, in his report has said that. Now, commission members also included former Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci, Admiral William J. Crowe, Jr., former chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, former Washington Governor Daniel J. Evans, United Negro College Fund President and former Democratic Representative William H. Gray, the third of Pennsylvania and former National League of Cities President and San Antonio Mayor Henry G. Cisneros,
yes.
Right, and the World Bank President Barbara Knobel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what all these things means today, what it really means that what we are witnessing around the world and what we have also witnessed, the movement of the Islamic fundamentalists throughout the world and every hot spot that we observe, whether it's in the Middle East or the former Soviet republics or in Algeria, in Egypt, and even in Iran, is all as a result of the fundamentalist movement at one point of time were very instrumental to create this new world order.
Mm-hmm.
And now that the situation somewhat in absence of the Soviet domination and Soviet empire, or quote-unquote evil empire, I've created a new situation in Iran. I have predicted long time ago that we are going to see many movement and many incidents such as the things that is happening and we are observing throughout the world, and the latest one we see the bombing of the World Trade Center in New York,
right,
that is being linked to the fundamentalist in the Middle East. And we have to ask, what was the purpose of that, and who benefited from all this?
Mm-hmm.
That is the issue.
Yep. I agree completely. I would note, too, some interesting details that have emerged. First of all, when the bomb first went off, it was described for several days, and people can go back to February 26th. Actually, the first day in the press would have been February 27th. The explosive was described as plastic explosive, which is very difficult to get a hold of. If you have plastic explosive, ultimately you must have gotten that from a military or intelligence outfit, because it's just not easy to get a hold of. Then, over the period of time, the explosive itself metamorphosed, rightly or wrongly, and obviously I wasn't there, so I can't state absolutely what it was, and I'm not an explosives expert anyway, but at first it was described as a plastic explosive. That was true for several days. Then it became either dynamite, now homemade explosives. A Croatian group, and the Ustashi, the World War II fascist collaborators of the Third Reich, like so many Third Reich elements then, or fascist elements, reconvened after World War II, and many of them were connected with the more extreme elements of U.S. intelligence. Croatian extremists were described as having phoned in about the blast 15 minutes before it occurred. Some 50-odd groups were described as having called up to take credit either shortly afterward or within a relatively short period of time. That then changed. They put the kibosh on that. I would note that this fellow, Mohammed Salome, I call him Lee Harvey Salome, then turns up with nitrate on his fingers, and he wants to get this van, and I don't know what role he may or may not have played. He might actually have been involved in some way as a low-level operative. Perhaps he's just a patsy, as I suspect. Maybe he's under mind control, too, which is another possibility. But now we're being told that this blast apparently was linked to Islamic fundamentalists. I noted, Farah, that of the papers that I've read, only the New York Times has stated that New York City law enforcement officials are absolutely livid over U.S. government, over federal authorities' leaks concerning the investigation, which, according to New York law enforcement officials, permitted a leak that which went to Newsday, which forced the premature arrest of Salome and, in all probability, the escape, at least for the time being, of associates. I mention that because it suggests at least the possibility of collusion on behalf of the investigators with the perpetrators. I also note that this Islamic fundamentalist minister or preacher, this cleric who has been linked with Mohammed Salome and with this fellow Nasser, convicted in connection with the assassination of Meir Kahane, that he was investigated in connection with, although acquitted, in connection with the assassination of Anwar Sadat, because the Sadat assassination, the trail of that points in the direction of the United States. I hope to get to that. Some of those connections next week. Anwar Sadat was assassinated by Islamic fundamentalists. It's worth noting that two days before he was killed, Hosni Mubarak, his successor, was meeting with George Bush. On the other side of Anwar Sadat was a fellow named Ghazala, who became the Egyptian Minister of Defense and was involved in the Itzko affair with some of the very people we've been talking about. Mubarak escaped unscathed. Ghazala escaped unscathed. Anwar Sadat got 28 rounds. And William Buckley, a CIA operative and for a time one of the top people, in fact, I believe he was chief of mission in Beirut, he was involved with putting together Anwar Sadat's security. And the behavior of Anwar Sadat's guards at the time of the assassination was very curious. They, rather than attempting to interdict Sadat's assassins, they turned their guns on the press. They didn't fire, but they turned their guns on the press photographers and said no pictures, which is a very strange way for a security detail to react when the person they're supposed to protect is being assassinated. William Buckley then, of course, was kidnapped by some of the kidnappers in the Middle East linked to Iran and to Islamic extremism, Iranian-based Islamic fundamentalism. And then the attempts to free William Buckley from his captors provided the rationale for the creation of the U.S. national security infrastructures designed to combat terrorism, which Oliver North utilized in the Iran-Contra scandal. Locating all of this, at least in terms of evidentiary tributaries, not necessarily hard connections, but evidentiary tributaries with the elements that we've been talking about and with what I've been talking about in Radio Free America 38. What, in your opinion, Farah, does the future hold in terms of the future of the Islamic fundamentalist movement and how it relates to the U.S. national security establishment?
Well, to begin with, I have to say that the Islamic fundamentalist movement on a global level, in absence of the Soviet Empire, right now is being looked at by many of the third world countries as a tool and a vehicle that they can unite behind that. A good example of that was last year, that, for instance, the KPFK had almost about a 3 days program on all the Islamic countries being represented on a program And what happened was that all the Islamic countries that participated in that program, all of a sudden, their slogan, which it was being aired, was not the different countries that they were a part of the Islamic countries within the Middle East. However, their slogan was that Islam is the new savior of the world. Now, the program became actually 3 days. I have never remember during all the years that I have listened, for instance, to KPFK, that all of a sudden 3 days program to be actually dedicated to one specific religion.
By the way, I would mention that KPFK is the Pacifica station in Los Angeles. Go ahead.
Right. And all of a sudden the things turn around. What is important is to see what is the substance of all these Islamic fundamentalist movement. What do they want to accomplish? What is their objective? What they did? We should not forget that through the secret alliance that behind the door was made between the George Bush's loyalist and the Khomeini's fundamentalist, created the first Islamic Republic in the nature that it had in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And subsequent to that, we find that the New World Order emerged.
Go ahead.
What is important is that right now, in most of the hot spots around the world, including but not limited to Somalia, we see that these fundamentalists for years have been supported by the members of the national security establishment within the United States for a specific use within these countries.
Mm-hmm. Which was?
Well, Iran, you know, for instance, in Egypt, we see it, right, for instance, in Somalia. Where do you think that the Somalian fundamentalists were getting the weapon from?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know, from the United States.
And who were they fighting? They were fighting the, for instance, quote-unquote, the members of the left or the supporters of the Soviet policies within these countries. So this was a fight between the national security establishment using the fundamentalist in different part of the world
as an anti-communist.
Communism.
Right, go ahead.
Okay, now in absence of communism, these people have become a powerful force.
Okay.
Now, in Iran, we see that, for instance, there is a rival group, which is the supposedly the moderate and the traditionalist. They both are fundamentalists. The only difference that they have is just how to preserve certain relationship or certain parts within the country that they would like to keep a control and nothing is going to change. But the fact is that I see that all the excuses that is being made, for instance, in February 13, 1993, just recently, there was shortly after the demonstration by the Iranian in Los Angeles against the regime in Iran, LA Times published an article by Robin Wright, and she, in that article, stated that Iran to Clinton is going to be the same as what
Iraq
was to George Bush.
In other words, basically, if I'm interpreting her prognostication correctly, that would be the goal for Clinton's military adventure abroad, much as Iraq was for Bush.
That's correct.
And, of course, we also supported Saddam Hussein.
What I'm predicting is this, that what is happening since the election of Clinton to the office, during George Bush's last day, many members of the Islamic fundamentals, including Yazdi, were permitted and they were traveling all over the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to Southern California. One of the problems that I've been facing is since his visit to Los Angeles.
Okay.
Okay. Now, I confronted, in fact, with my questioning as I talked last time with the conversation that I had on January 12th with Gary Sick, I brought many of these issues that was happening, and he said to me that, well, in many of his writings, he has written a lot of things about that, which I told him that, yes, I found it very interesting that you have written, but I found it more interesting that there are many things that it was of significance. It was never discussed in any of your writings about what was happening in Iran. For instance, the Qarani issue, the intelligence briefing issue, the nuclear weapon program issue, all these things was never ever touched by him. And what it is important, and I told him that I find it more interesting, is that these matters were not being discussed by a man of your stature who professes to be giving us a historical perspective on what was really behind October Surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And in that respect, I told him that I beg to differ with you. And he said, and I quote him, he says, okay, I mean, you are certainly entitled to the point of view, and I don't. There are many things in the course of my research I have not mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this, after all, was a major historical event, and you obviously place a tremendous amount of emphasis on these particular events, and I do not. But that is a difference of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Close quote. That was not a difference of an opinion. The fact of the matter is that these issues that I am raising and I investigated and I came up with played an important role in shaping the Islamic Republic of Iran,
mm-hmm.
which Mr. Gerasik failed to mention. These were the antecedent historical events that took place before the October Surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do not discuss these things, you would not be able to put the October Surprise in a proper perspective. And that is why that they put emphasis on the issues that it was very easy to disprove. But if you go and look at the situation in Iran from mid-70s, when today they're talking about the nuclear weapon program in Iran, but they fail to mention all the evidence from 1974.
Mm-hmm.
When they talk about the events that was taking place in Iran, they're talking about Shah's demise in 1976. They're talking about his successor in 1976, 2 days after Carter was elected to the office. These are the issues that have been ignored. And if you don't touch on those issues, you do not understand why the Islamic fundamentalist movement now emerging in the world on control, and they do anything that they want at will. Why, for instance, the Islamic fundamentalists in Iran have got a control over the Iranians, and they put them in the state of terror, that they would come and they would pick up on individuals like me that is trying to expose them so they can discredit me.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I would point out, Farah, is that when our national security establishment decides to move in any given major direction, they do so when to make that move will satisfy a number of different strategic considerations at different levels simultaneously. And these people are not stupid, and they're not incapable. As you've noted in one of our previous interviews, they have access to the finest supercomputers around, the finest people to operate those, and they're very, very intelligent and very dedicated to what they do. Fundamentalist religion in general has been promoted by elements of our national security establishment, both because it is anti-communist. Fundamentalist Christians are also anti-communist. And now, in the post-war period, post-Cold War period, I should say, Islamic fundamentalism may loom as an enemy which, if not as potent as the Soviet Union, could at least serve as a rationalization for continued enormous defense expenditures in this country, as well as for a more aggressive military posture abroad than we might otherwise have. As well, at least the threat of terrorism can also serve as a pretext for cracking down on civil liberties in the United States. Broader police powers, broader surveillance powers, etc. At some point, maybe we could, in a future broadcast, we can get into, I think, some of the even broader and more long-term considerations of religious fundamentalism, because as we destroy the planet physically, and from a physical standpoint, the planet Earth is in dire straits right now. The erosion of the ozone layer, the destruction of the rainforests, either of those, the greenhouse effect, also could literally destroy all life on Earth, or at least all human life. And with a disintegrating world economy that I think is going to begin disintegrating at a much more rapid pace, one of the things that religious dedication can do, that fundamentalist religion can do, is to help blunt the impact of these things. My academic background is in psychology, and psychologists refer to one of the governing dynamics of human life. They refer to it as the reality principle. In other words, basically, you have to deal with your environment. You have to grasp what your environment requires of you in terms of rate, whether it's working or growing food or avoiding the cold or disease or whatever, and you must deal with those things. And in a world in which, from an environmental and economic standpoint, and I think ultimately politically, because of those two, reality is going to become increasingly unpalatable to most of the human race. It is going to leave human beings with basically a decision of whether to act to change their environment in such a way as to make it more habitable, more hospitable, or else somehow to adjust to the increasingly less hospitable environment. And a fundamentalist religion, just like drug use or alcohol use, can blunt an individual's sense of reality and their adjustment to that reality. If, just for example, you are a multinational corporation and you are engaged in seriously polluting the earth and abusing your workforce, not that all of them do that, but many of them do, and you wish the workforce to continue to be pliant in spite of the harsh conditions, and if you wish the people who are suffering because of the environmental destruction to continue to suffer, among the ways you can induce them to do that is to get them to believe in some sort of otherworldly solution to these problems, whether it's salvation through Allah or through Jesus or through a Jewish Messiah or through a New Age Messiah, because New Age, there are very strong connections between some elements of the so-called New Age in this country and the national security establishment. That is among the geopolitical goals, I believe, of our national security establishment's active support for not only Islamic fundamentalism, but for fundamentalist religion in general. I just wanted to put that bug out there, because I suspect that also has much to do with what has been going on over the past quarter century. The connections, for example, in the U.S. between right-wing Christians and our national security establishment are very well documented. Many listeners, and perhaps yourself also, far are familiar with the work of Sarah Diamond, who's done some good work in putting together the nomenclature of the Christian right and some of their connections. It's not a new phenomenon, but that's something else I would call to your attention and to the attention of the audiences. Farah, we've got about 50 minutes to the top of the broadcast. I don't have time to do the other material that I was going to present this evening. This is not said in regret, because I wanted you to be able to not only relate the frightening circumstances that you have been in, but also to share with us the groundbreaking research concerning the U.S.-Iranian nuclear collaboration, its implications for U.S. posture both at home and abroad today, and to, most fascinatingly to me, to connect that up with the very same Triple Wilson milieu that I have been focusing on for more than a decade. I was wondering, at this point, Farah, is that what would you like to say by way of conclusion? Because I would like to put a wrap on things.
Well, I really that a few things that I would like to say.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, many of these documents and some of the discussions that I have had on your program, this is for the benefit of many of your listeners.
All of us, I would say.
You know, that we feel that why such an important issues and information have not been heard.
Mm-hmm.
It is not that I did not try. It is not because I have got a copy of every correspondence that I've had with major news media, with all the documents that I sent to every single one of them, including to LA Times reporters, on their own articles that I challenged them. Why didn't they investigate the article that was published on August 22, 1979, Los Angeles Times by Robert Gillette, which it was titled, quote, Iran's purchase of laser process from LA company widen nuclear capability.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the article exposed the deal of this laser, and you know, there was another article that it was published in March of 1980 that indicated actually Iran's nuclear bomb capability. what it shows to us that we are living in the environment, in the system, that they do not allow the truth to come out. We have been lied to, we have been deceived, and people that they go and they put their life on the line, on the front line to investigate, they do not have the equal chances to present their case and present their research and present the documents
to the
public.
That's why I'm giving you this forum this evening.
That's right. Class. There are very, very few forums that we have. One is yours.
Mm-hmm.
One is, for instance, Roy Tuchman and partially KPFK, and say that Cabu in Portland, Oregon by Marlene Smith and mm-hmm. Lenny Zinkin.
Mm-hmm.
And if the people and the listeners of your program, if they do not support us, we have done the work and we have put our life on the line, and they are trying at all time to discredit us. We cannot do it alone.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We have to get their support. I have done everything that I could to the point that right now, as I am talking to you, my mother has been in this country for a month and a half. I have had no opportunity to meet with this woman that I love very much. Why? Because I have felt that I do not want to create any danger for that woman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you live in that sort of, I'm not a man of paranoia problems.
Well, there's a difference between paranoia, which is neurotic fear, and real fear, which is the sort of fear you've been experiencing. Go ahead.
You know, and we are losing everything that we have. The price of a for democracy, it is not cheap. There are many people that have given their lives. I was asked by one of my relatives tonight, why do I have to do this? Because the price for the people that are coming after me, after you, for their rights, for their civil liberties, for their democracy, is a price that somebody has to pay. And the forum that is given the opportunity to people like me, to people like you, are very limited. And if they don't get the support to stay on, we can be shut up very easily.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that you have to support you, not to only be the listeners. To listening, nothing would change.
Mm-hmm.
To act upon it.
Absolutely.
It does. And I am not asking people to come to save me. But when I am being crucified over there, and people like us, that they are trying to discredit us, to make us some bunch of kooks, some bunch of, you know, violent individuals, is not us that they are trying to discredit. Is the message that we want to get across. They would like to discredit.
Incidentally, speaking of that, there's an interesting detail, Farah. I don't know if you would feel comfortable discussing this, but after our first couple of conversations off the air, or actually, I guess it was after maybe one of our first interviews on the air, you asked me what I thought of David McMichael, who was a former CIA analyst who has ostensibly at least turned against his former employers. And you had been in contact with McMichael, and you might want to tell us what he had to say about your research out of print, because you asked me what I thought of him and what would happen.
I have had, on many occasions, I have had supports of him for my research. In fact, in many conversations that I had, he felt that some of my material, some of my research paper, particularly I sent a copy of it to him, and he felt that it was very compelling, and he felt that the real story behind the October Surprise is the story that I have analyzed.
Right.
However, when he reviewed my work...
Well, before, but let me interrupt, Farah, because you asked me, because he has recently come into print...
Yes.
Vis-a-vis your work. But before that happened, you asked me what I thought of him and what I thought he would say about your work.
Yes, you're right. It was about 10 days before the review came out, and
right.
I asked you that what your opinion was of David McMichael, and you, with reservation, you said that I should be very careful because the situation has been in the past that he really did not, as he tells you that he's going to do something, the result and the outcome of the conversation has been always very surprisingly different than the things that people have heard from him before the publication of the review on the work.
Mm-hmm.